You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, proudly supported by Lacca. Lacca is the headline sponsor of our Spring Monuments coverage from Milan-San Remo to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and they're offering our listeners a sweet deal to kick things off. More on that later. Lacca's cover is designed by cyclists for cyclists, making sure you're never left stranded. Unlike traditional insurers, there are no upfront fixed fees, and they won't charge you a fixed sum. Instead, they calculate your monthly contributions up to a maximum capped amount based on the collective's claims. Fewer claims mean you pay less, simple as that. Plus, there's no depreciation or excess when claiming for your bike or gear, just expert-backed coverage as tough as the Spring Classics. Check out this Trustpilot review, which says, "Brilliant cycle insurance with no hassle claims process." It goes on, "I've been a customer from the outset. It really is the best cycle insurance around. The claim process is very easy with no excess, and you're covered for what you state the value of your bike is, not what someone else thinks the market value is. Premiums can be lower if claims within the group are down, so this is a shared risk model, which is exactly the way insurance should be. There's a great team behind the company as well, meaning this really is a top-class outfit. Highly recommended." So whether you're tackling the Ardennes or joining the weekend club ride, Lacca's specialist bike insurance goes the extra mile. Lacca are live in the UK, Netherlands, France, Belgium and Germany. And listeners in these regions can get their first 30 days free when they sign up with the code TCP30 at lacca.co/TCP. That's TCP30 at lacca.co/TCP to get 30 days of free cover. Now it's on with the show.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello, and joining you on April the 10th, 2025, in a week when Tadej Pogacar put his name to the fastest ever Tour of Flanders, was hailed as the greatest cyclist ever by Mads Pedersen, and 24 hours later got booed and heckled for being too slow to get to his seat with fiancé Urszka Zegart at the Monte Carlo Masters Tennis Tournament. My name is Daniel Freeber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, and today I'm ready for everything. Adulation, hyperbole, and catcalls. We inspect settled dust over Flanders and wonder what's in store for Pog et al. In Paris-Roubaix at the weekend. Still shuffling through the aisles to join me with his mega bucket of popcorn and big slurp milkshake. It's Lionel Burney.
No, Daniel, I haven't got a big slurp milkshake. I've got the king of drinks in Roussillara on Monday after my secret mission. More of that later on. Not so secret mission now. I went for a cappuccino. It was just after noon, and it was served with a little mini ice cream on the side in a cone. The cup had as well as a cup handle, it had a little holder for a tiny ice cream cone. I don't know whether you were supposed to put the ice cream in the cappuccino. I don't think so. I ate it separately. Absolutely peak cappuccino. I know you would have enjoyed something like that.
A travestino. And loudly streaming YouTube videos while the umpire requests quiet, please, for the third time. It's Rob Hatch.
Hello.
Did you chaps, how are you doing, Rob?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. Did you chaps see that? Pog and Urszka almost getting kicked out. Monte Carlo at the weekend.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, they're back among the rich and famous now, aren't they? They're just citizens again when they're there. They've got to behave.
They do indeed. I'm not sure who they were watching, actually, but I do know that, for example, I know that there's a WhatsApp group of the sort of sporting rich and famous in Monte Carlo, which Yannick Sinner, for example, is in. Tadej Pogacar is also in. Carlos Sainz, the F1 driver. So there's a lot of sort of hobnobbing between famous sports people that goes on in Monte Carlo. But enjoying a very well-deserved day off was old Pog at the tennis on Monday. Of course, he's got a busy week ahead, hasn't he, chaps? Paris-Roubaix at the weekend. Interesting that he decided to go back to the Côte d'Azur between Flanders and Roubaix. I suppose that's what I would have done in his shoes as well.
How the other half live, eh? I tell you what, though, if I'm looking at the weather, and Lionel, I know you're looking at it as well, he may be worth taking his raincoat, eh, at the weekend.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Looking that way, isn't it? Looking that way. Saturday is going to be absolutely glorious, warm and sunny, but it might turn overnight. I wanted to just ask about the Monte Carlo Masters Tennis. It's a clay court tournament, isn't it? Is that the cobblestones of tennis, the equivalent? I don't know.
The funny thing is, no, because if you leave UK and go to the rest of Europe, it's like the most normal surface in the world, and we're the weird ones having grass.
Oh, grass is the cobblestones of tennis.
Guys, can we just pause there? I've just got someone at the door.
Of course, yeah.
Sorry, one second.
Oh, I thought that was part of the... I thought we were in Crinkly Bottom then.
Who is it?
I thought that was part of the act.
It's Hugo Kurovits. Hi, Hugo.
Actually, producer, please leave this in. Oh, good.
Sorry, guys.
That's right. Who was at the door there, Daniel? Was it Hugo Kurovits?
Mr. Blobby?
It was a WADA inspector. No, it wasn't. It wasn't.
Well, no wonder, having seen your Strava times.
I've actually got a race on Saturday. No, it was someone wanting to check the water meter. This is demystifying the cycling podcast. We were talking about living on the Côte d'Azur, the glamour of professional cycling. Not water meters. Chaps, let's crack on indeed, because it's a busy week, busy episode. Lots going on in the news. It's time for the newsette. What have you each brought for us in your sack of shame or goodness or whatever it is today?
Well, Daniel, I'm going to take us to the Basque Country and it's Zulia, the week-long stage race that is midway through at the moment, and stage three. Yesterday's stage, which ended in farce, really. Alex Aramburu, the Spanish champion, Basque rider, of course, riding for Cofidis, was the winner, first over the line, but then he was stripped of his win for going, in inverted commas, the wrong way round the roundabout near the finish. And then he was reinstated as the winner. A lot of confusion, a lot of controversy, because it turned out that Aramburu had gone the way that was stipulated in the roadbook. He went to the right-hand side of the roundabout. There were some barriers directing the riders to go to the left-hand side of the roundabout, but he went to the right. Romain Grégoire was given the victory in the meantime, Aramburu stripped, until it was pointed out that Aramburu had gone the correct way, because that was what was stipulated in the roadbook, to take the right-hand side. It was also on Velo Viewer that the riders should take the right-hand side. And so, although Romain Grégoire had gone to the podium and had been awarded the victory, Alex Aramburu was later reinstated in the evening. A bit of a farce, really, but the correct result, of course. I just wonder how Philippe Ogana feels a month or so after the Volta ao Algarve, where he wasn't given a victory, having gone the correct way at a farcical finish, when pretty much everyone else, if you remember, went along a parallel road to the finish, and he took the correct finish line. So the rules not really being applied consistently across a couple of races, several weeks apart, but the correct outcome for Alex Aramburu, even if Romain Grégoire would probably feel a little bit hard done by.
Lionel, hang on a minute. The rules not being applied consistently in cycling? Not heard that before. Come on. Deary me.
Who will cycling's authorities reinstate long after the fact next?
Oh, you're opening up something there.
It's the rider's responsibility to know the route, right? The rider's and the team's responsibility to know the route. Sometimes in the roadbook, the line will go both sides of the roundabout, meaning that you can take both directions. Sometimes it will say one way or the other. But if the arrows and the direction on the road are inconsistent with the roadbook, it does make it difficult for the riders, even though they're supposed to know what is correct in the roadbook. They're 150 odd kilometers deep into a race, riding on adrenaline and stress. It's a difficult one, and I think really the race organizers bear the responsibility to make the finish, especially last 5 or 10K, incredibly clear, unequivocally clear.
Also, chaps, it was not a straightforward roundabout with just a left and a right turn, was it? Even the right turn was effectively more like straight on. And there might even have been, I'm not sure whether there was a third exit on the left-hand side, even sort of one round from where the riders actually went. There was no sort of, well, it was a very, very simple diagram in the road book, which made it look as though it was a clear choice between left and right, which wasn't really the case. Just sort of ironically, in a kind of Alanis Morissette sort of way, not really ironic, but FDJ, their riders went the right way, all of them, if I'm not mistaken, en masse, when Filippo Ganna won, in inverted commas, in the Algarve. And yesterday, of course, Romain Grégoire went the wrong way and paid for it.
Indeed. I mean, the Gruppetto took that third exit off the roundabout and ended up in the shopping centre.
Well, interested spectators to all of that would have been usual suspects at the bottom of the table and at the top of the second division table.
Oh, lovely segue. We're already on to our next item.
We are, because the promotion relegation is squeezing both at the bottom end of the top table and the top end of that pro team table. I almost said pro continent, and that's how far behind I am. A reminder, it's world teams and pro teams nowadays, isn't it? Rather than world tour and pro conti tour. But I had a look at the points, gents, a couple of days ago, 8th of April. There were less than 2,000 points, finally, between Exter Sastanar and UnoX, by the way, who were only two single points, amazingly separated, and then Picnic and Cofidis, who were right at the bottom of the top table. So 18,687 points for XTS Astana, 18,685 points for UnoX, and just in front, not even 2,000 points in front, Cofidis and Picnic Postenel. However, yesterday, the day before we're recording this, the day after I'd had a look, there was a big swing back to Cofidis, 50 points there for Aramburu for winning the stage. However, just to illustrate to everybody, because I know it's not particularly easy to follow when we're talking about thousands of points and silly stuff like that. Yesterday at the Skelderpres, Milan Fretin, fourth place, he picked up 100 points, double what Aramburu got for winning a stage of a World Tour race. Sixth place was Stanisław Aniołkowski, 70 points as well. So that's 170 points there for Cofidis. And I've just noticed in races, they've started to try and adopt the same tactic that XDS Astana are adopting. Get as many people up in the top 10 as possible in those one-day races.
Carpet
where you
bombing,
know there's a lot
finish
of points.
Lines.
Flooding the zone, I think it's called these days, isn't it? Flooding the zone.
Yeah. Chaps, it did make me wonder, just a glance at the latest rankings. You just mentioned, Rob, sort of Picnic post-NL suddenly imperiled. Obviously, we've got Romain Bardet, who is due to finish his career at the Dauphiné in June. And he is one of, in theory and in practice, I believe, he's one of that team's heaviest point scorers. Now, one obvious solution, you would think, to their relegation worries might be for him to prolong his career a little bit longer, particularly given that they are going to be missing at the weekend John Degenkolb, their former Paris-Roubaix winner who had a nasty crash in Flanders at the weekend. And he is out of Paris-Roubaix and he'll be out for a while.
And there's no Fabio Jakobsen anymore, of course. He's recovered from iliac artery surgery. There's been talk of the fact that he's going to miss the tour. I mean, let's be honest, he hasn't been on stage winning in the tour form for quite a while, has he? However, obviously we know why now.
This is an issue, actually, that I haven't heard anyone broach yet. But, for example, in football, we know we have the transfer windows. And one of the reasons we have transfer windows, one in January, for example, is to not sort of falsify the back end of the season so that teams cannot just sign 10 players in March in an effort to stave off relegation. Now, we have had mid-season transfers in cycling before. We do have them more and more regularly, I would suggest. And it would be interesting if, come July, come August, if a team sought to go down that route, whether that would be allowed or not.
It certainly would be a tactic, wouldn't it? I mean, the headline at the minute from the promotion and relegation is that UnoX are now also in contention with XDS Astana. For UnoX, it would be promotion. For Astana, it would be trying to save themselves against relegation. And as you mentioned, Picnic Postenel joining Cofidis right down at the bottom there. They are now real candidates for relegation, both of them.
Well, just slightly related, the Vuelta a España has announced its wildcards for this season's race, Q36.5. Tom Pidcock's team, of course, are going to ride the Vuelta. They're already guaranteed a place in the Giro d'Italia as a result of the wild card given to them there, but they won't be riding the Tour de France. The other two wild cards are Spanish teams, Burgos BH and Caja Rural, but no place for Kern Pharma, who won three stages last year. I think that's quite a surprise.
I would say so. It's their squad rotation system, isn't it, continuing? Because last year it was Euskaltel alongside Kern Pharma who got those Spanish teams' wild cards. This year it's gone back to Burgos. It's gone back to Caja Rural. But, I mean, what's the point in winning three stages then, gents, if you can't go again next year?
It's kind of pulled the wool from everyone's eyes as far as that is what is actually happening with the Vuelta, isn't it? It is rotation. There is no real link to sporting merit.
Which is a nonsense, really. I mean, like you say, Rob, what is the point? If you win three stages and don't get an invite the following year, that's not sport taking the priority, is it?
And if you look at, obviously with Q36.5 being invited, if you look at, you know, the fact that they've got an extra wild card, right, this was a perfect year for them to reward sporting merit and then keep their promise to other Spanish teams, wasn't it? But Q36.5 are there instead. I mean, you can understand that perhaps they've promised, let's say, that it would be speculation, wouldn't it? But they maybe promised that certain star riders might be attending, and obviously that's another attraction for the Vuelta as well, isn't it?
Chaps, a final bit of news from me this week. It's a sort of sad or certainly alarming bit of news brought to our attention by our colleagues at L'Equipe. And yesterday they ran an interview with the former rider Juan Ofredo, only 38 years old, retired in 2000, I believe, after almost a decade with FDJ Groupama, what was then FDJ. And then the back end of his career he spent at the sort of Wanty team. And Juan Ofredo has been working in the media since he retired. A very good and insightful pundit on French television, among other things. But last year he was working for RTL in Belgium, and he was commentating on the Giro d'Italia, and he developed vision problems. He noticed a white spot in his vision, in his eye, which prompted him to see an ophthalmologist who immediately recognized it was serious and referred him to a specialized center. After that, it took a long time to get any sort of diagnosis. And in fact, even now, specialists, as far as Ofredo was suggesting, they're not entirely 100% sure what the problem is. But the sort of provisional diagnosis is sarcoidosis, which is a problem which can affect the eyes, the lungs and the brain. And again, a sort of tentative prognosis suggests that he might eventually, and in fairly short order, lose his vision in the next couple of years. Obviously, this has caused him significant anguish, mental health problems. He talked in the interview about having put on a lot of weight. I think he said about 10 or 20, maybe even 20 kilos. But since then, or in the last few months, he started, I think, riding his bike again and certainly being much more active again, and is hopeful that some sort of, well, first of all, a more definitive diagnosis will be given, and that maybe there'll be treatment options which prevent that sort of doomsday scenario of him losing his vision. But yeah, that was a surprise to read, and certainly our thoughts go to Juan Ofredo. As I said, good rider in his day. He won the Tour of Picardie, which was his biggest race win. Also seventh in Milan-San Remo, finished in the top 10 in a number of big one-day races. And as I said, I'd certainly enjoyed his punditry on French television. Also a very charming and thoughtful, intelligent chap, if ever you met and spoke to him. So our best wishes to Juan Ofredo.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Saily. Saily is an eSIM brought to you by the creators of NordVPN, and it will ensure that you can stay connected when you're abroad without racking up roaming charges. When you're travelling, whether on holiday or for work, it can be a real drag to have to pay extra fees just to use your phone as you would when you're at home. Let's face it, you want to be able to stay in contact with people or use social media, listen to podcasts or watch streaming services, and these can all drain your data and leave you with additional fees to pay. So how does Saily work? Well, it's very simple. You download the app, which is compatible with Apple iOS or Android devices, and it works on all smartphones that support eSIM technology. Then you buy the plan that suits you. If you're traveling to more than one country, you don't need to install a new eSIM for each one. You just buy a global or regional plan that covers the countries you're visiting. Install and activate your eSIM, and you'll easily connect to a local network as soon as you arrive at your destination. It's affordable too, and will significantly reduce or even eliminate roaming charges. And because it's powered by NordVPN, you know your connections are secure as well. All Cycling Podcast listeners can get a great deal today. Download the Saily app in your app store and use the code CYCLING at checkout to get 15% off your first purchase. Or go to saily.com/cycling. That's saily.com/cycling.
Well, chaps, the dust has sort of settled over the Tour of Flanders. Doesn't sound as though we'll be getting a dusty edition of Paris-Roubaix at the weekend, although those are generally my favourite ones, my favourite editions. I've spoken about this before. I prefer the dry, fast ones rather than the wet, sloppy ones, generally speaking. Flanders. Let's just revisit that for a moment because we did record our Arrivée episode on the whistle, more or less, just a couple of hours after the race had finished on Sunday. Lionel, you were in your car in the lay-by, in the now infamous lay-by.
Not in a lay-by.
We didn't know at the time. We didn't know. I think you said you were in a lay-by. We didn't know. We have subsequently learned, or were told anyway, I think we do believe it, but we were told that Mathieu van der Poel was or had been suffering from illness in the days leading up to Tour of Flanders. This information came from, it was Christoph Rudolph, wasn't it? In an interview, the Alpecin, one of the Alpecin team bosses, after the finish, he talked about van der Poel having, I think he'd messaged Rudolph on April Fool's Day. And Christoph Rudolph thought that it was a gag, not a very good gag. And van der Poel followed this up with another message to say, no, I'm deadly serious. I am sick as a dog, sick as Lionel is today. Lionel's suffering a little bit today. And he was subsequently put on antibiotics, which actually alarmed me slightly because the prevailing wisdom, I think, in the medical community is that antibiotics are overprescribed nowadays. And if it was a sort of cold or, you know, mild, I don't think it was flu, but I'm not sure that's the kind of thing that antibiotics should be used for. Anyway, that was what we were told, and we were sort of led to believe that this had maybe impaired his performance at the weekend. Any thoughts, chaps?
I know that if you think back to Arel Bakker and the podium, you remember him shivering away there. It was a long, long podium ceremony. There's lots of beer being sprayed. There's lots of very, very over-enthusiastic fans
This is real.
This is like saying he went out with wet hair, but it fits, doesn't it? I mean, the medical community, anyone listening is going to be screaming at their iPhones or other device at their quackery. This is absolute quackery here. I think when we first heard this shortly after recording, Daniel, I had assumed that it was Mathieu van der Poel who had said he'd been unwell. And I kind of, my instant reaction was, it's kind of frustrating to watch a 6-hour race play out or just under 6-hour race play out. And then for the guy that's not one to say, oh, well, I was unwell anyway. But if it came from the team, I kind of retract that.
In his defence, Lyle, in his defence, he'd said it in the week as well. He'd said it in the week leading up. He'd said it in the week. He'd sort of let it, but it was very quietly done in the Flemish press. It was sort of one of those, well, are you taking him seriously or not? It was a bit like you were both suggesting there. You know, it was April Fool's week,
wasn't it? No one believes anything that any riders say in the run-up to one of their biggest objectives of the season either, do they? It's kind of valueless words. Oh, I'm not feeling too well. I mean, you take it at face value, but I mean, it could be anything, couldn't it? Be a bit of kidology. I don't know. I mean, you line up, if you line up at the start and race, then, you know, your performance is judged on the result and the performance on the road. I don't know. I felt a slight bit, because it takes the edge off what we thought of Pogacar's performance, perhaps. You know, it sort of mixes up all of that context that we're trying to assess what that performance was like, and it just sort of, you know, it means that the race felt a little bit like it was on quicksand after that. I just feel maybe old school here, I just like to not know really that were we watching a 100% Matthew van der Poel? Possibly not. Will it have an impact on Sunday? Maybe it will, but like I say, the result is the result. And if you line up, you're well enough to race, is my thinking.
Rule number 76, no excuses, play like a champion. That's from Wedding Crashers, of course. We're not suggesting that he was making excuses. Chaps, just on excuses, and this is a nice segue maybe to our, well, not to our next item, because I think next we're going to talk about Tadej Pogacar and put his win in Flanders in context a little bit. But we are going to talk about Lotto, the Lotto team, in a minute. And Lionel, I mentioned to you at the weekend when we were talking about Van der Poel's purported illness, I remembered a conversation with Mario Arts, the Belgian rider in the early noughties. Now, he won Flesh well on, I can't remember what year it was, 2001, I think. I haven't got it in front of me. But he was touted as the big Belgian hope for example, the Tour de France in years thereafter, after winning Flèche Wallonne. And I did an interview with him a few years later, and we talked about why his career hadn't quite panned out that way. And he told me that he would spend every Flèche Wallonne, these 4 or 5 hours that he spent on the bike that day, thinking of what excuse he was going to use to the Belgian press after the finish, thinking of what illness he was going to invent to account for the fact that it hadn't gone as well as he and the journalists were expecting. I think I've told that story probably on the podcast before. But chaps, as I said, we'll get on to Lotto in just a second. Next, one of the other big themes after Tadej Pogacar's latest masterclass at the weekend was the conversation that we're having with increasing frequency, and we've been having a lot, certainly in the last couple of years, is what does this mean? Where does that place him in the pantheon? And how close is he now to the sort of high watermark, the ultimate benchmark as far as cycling palmarèses are concerned? That is Eddy Merckx's. And there were a few comments, some of them sort of off the cuff, and I don't think said with great sort of feeling. For example, Mads Pedersen in his interview after the finish talked about Pogacar being the greatest cyclist ever. I don't think we should necessarily hold Mads Pedersen to that. It wasn't as though he had sort of Eddy Merckx's palmarès open in front of him and he was consulting the two things, and this was a sort of considered forensic judgment. We also had the aforementioned controversial Lance Armstrong, I think, saying that now Pogacar had surpassed Eddy Merckx. But yes, chaps, it was a question that was certainly raised on Sunday night and Monday. Your instinctive initial reactions and thoughts on the matter?
Well, first of all, context, caveats, they're always going to exist, aren't they? Back in Merckx's day, there were plenty more race days a season. So when you look at the palmarès at the minute, the number of victories that Merckx had in all races, not just the big ones, completely dwarfs that of Pogacar, who's approaching 100. Merckx was, what, 260 plus, 270 plus, something like that off the top of my head. And then if you look at the number of monuments, the number of Grand Tours, Pogacar is still a heck of a long way away. However, Pogacar now is at exactly halfway in his career to what Merckx managed to pull off. Merckx, I think, had a 14-year career from memory. Pogacar's 7 seasons in now. If he wins on Sunday, that would be a completely different type of race again, to add to the sort of, I'm going to say the arsenal of
I'm glad someone's mentioned Arsenal this week.
Well, there you go. At least I've got something right today. Yeah, it's not been a bad week for you lot. You just wait till next week, I guess. But no, it's not been a bad week for you lot. In terms of what Pogacar's been able to pull off, I think as well as the number, when you're comparing him to somebody like Merckx, you want to look at the type of races, don't you? And the fact that he's gone and won Flanders, he's been very close in San Remo, already sort of puts him on the way to the Merckx step on the top of everything, doesn't it? The number of victories, the way he's won things as well, I think really has to come into account, doesn't it? You know, the long range attacks, the eating everything up and just destroying the competition. So he's up there on that level. If he wins Roubaix, another completely different type of race, then for me, you can really start having the conversation. Yes, of course, he's got to win more. You can also argue that, like I said right at the start, the number of days influences things as well, the number of races he's able to win. But I think that if he wins Roubaix, you can have that conversation then. Just one other thing before Lionel Aziz say on this. If Tadej Pogacar wins Roubaix, he draws level with our good mate Sean Kelly on the number of monuments as well. So, you know, he's really, really up there in terms of his one-day racing. And I think after Sunday, I think I said this on the commentary, his monument win percentage is absolutely ridiculous. It's in the high 40% races like that that he's won. And races, let's not forget that if you are what's been a traditional GC contender in the last 30 years or so, you usually don't even start half of those races, never mind win 40-odd% of them. So for me, yeah, maybe a Roubaix this weekend, then we can really start having the conversation, because he's getting there, isn't he?
Yes, he is. I mean, I always think these comparisons are a little bit redundant, aren't they? Because the sport in the late 60s and 70s is completely different to what we're watching now in so many ways. I mean, the athletes are different shape, the bikes are different, the roads are different. You know, Eddie Merckx, I think, was sort of, 74 kilos is kind of racing weight. Daniel, you'll probably know this much better than I. And he dominated. He was head and shoulders above across the classics and the Grand Tours for a considerable period of time. You know, I think even if Pogacar carries on another 7 years and keeps adding races to his already very impressive list, he's probably not going to get close to what Merckx managed to win. But the depth of the field is stronger now. The teams are better, more organised. There's more, despite his sort of dominance, there is more competition, I think. I would say. I mean, I didn't live through the Eddie Merckx era, so I'm kind of judging what I've read and watched in black and white, really. But he's undoubtedly in the same orbit as Eddie Merckx, isn't he? We haven't seen a rider this good across Grand Tours and major classics since Merckx, I would say. Even Bernardino was not, you know, he was not as good as Tadej Pogacar across such a broad spectrum of races, even though he won the Tour de France 5 times and, you know, won the Giro and the world title and some classics. So it's a conversation. I think I agree with you, Rob. You know, if he were to win Paris-Roubaix, which I think is a big ask, but if he were to win it, then you can put them in the same sentence in the conversation, can't you? Daniel, yeah. I mean, you wrote about Merckx extensively. I mean, what's your view?
Well, I think they're in a category of two now. I think it is Merckx and Pogacar. I think you mentioned the sort of breadth of the Palmares line. There are significant holes in the other sort of, if you think of the kind of the Mount Rushmore of professional cycling, you know, we always look to the 5-time Tour de France winners. Anquetil had big sort of holes in his. He was much more, he was kind of ahead of his time in the sense that he was very much a stage race and very much a sort of Tour de France specialist. We've had others who were, you know, Eno was very versatile, won Paris-Roubaix, didn't win the Tour of Flanders. So sort of there's big holes as far as Belgian one-day races, that kind of race is concerned. Indurain, of course, the prototypical Tour de France specialist. So Pogacar certainly is the closest, and he's very similar to Merckx in terms of spanning everything, with the possible exception of Paris-Roubaix, which will maybe be remedied at the weekend. You know, there are other races that didn't exist in Merckx's day, Strade Bianche, for example, races that were more prestigious back then, which have become less prestigious since. Certainly that, you know, I don't think Pogacar is going to win five Giri d'Italia. I might be wrong. But Merckx did win the Giro five times. Pogacar hasn't yet won the Vuelta. I think we think he's going to do it this year. If he takes part, I'm pretty sure he's going to win. The Vuelta, in Merckx's day, I would argue that you could almost not consider it a Grand Tour in the sense that it was sort of 17 stages. The race rarely went above sort of 1,200 metres altitude. So that's changed a lot. But it's a conversation that we are going to continue to have, I would say. I was looking at an all-time ranking on a popular results website the other day, which sort of tabulates all these things.
Well, let's give it a credit. Pro Cycling Stats.
I was
looking at the same one.
Yes, and I was sort of aghast to see that Laurent Jalabert is still significantly well ahead of Tadej Pogacar, according to that, which just the mind boggled at that, how he'd amassed enough points to be, as I said, at least three or four positions still ahead of Pogacar on that.
Well, yeah, I mean, consistency, really. He was a sort of Sean Kelly light type rider, wasn't he? He was decent in Grand Tours, won a Vuelta, of course, won classics, won tour stages, finished very high up in the tour. Fourth, I think, was his best result, if I'm not mistaken. You know, racked up a lot of wins in, I think, Paris-Nice three times, I think. I think when it comes down to Merckx and Pogacar, I mean, famously, the only race, major race, as it was considered at the time, that Eddie Merckx didn't win was Paris-Tours. So maybe to do it, Tadej Pogacar has to line up at Paris-Tours and win that. And that will nudge him ahead.
This was always Roger De Vlaeminck's big contention, and Rick Van Looy as well, that they both won Paris-Tours and Merckx did not. Therefore, he was not a complete rider. Merckx, puff. Chaps, let's move on because I suspect we'll be having this conversation again at some point. We have been talking there about bygone eras and an era of sorts, or the end of an era, or certainly a historical landmark has been reached in the last week or so. Is it the actual anniversary, 40 years this week, Lionel? Why would it be in
more
April?
Or less, yeah. This is the Belgian Lotto team, the longest running sponsor in professional cycling. It's not the oldest team. Movistar has that honour because it goes back to 1980, and the Reynolds team, you can trace the lineage of that team all the way back to 1980. But the Lotto team, which started in 1985, Lotto, the Belgian lottery, of course, has been a named sponsor, either primary or secondary title sponsor, for four decades. And it's quite a landmark, really. And last week marked the 40th anniversary of their first ever win. It was on April the 2nd, 1985. Paul Hagedorn won the Grand Prix Pinot-Trois-Ami in Belgium. And I mean, the history of the Lotto team is quite interesting, really, because it started out as very much a sort of domestic Belgian team. In fact, for the first few years, the first 7 years of its existence, it had an entirely Belgian roster of riders, except for Eric McKenzie of New Zealand, who rode for them for a couple of years in the early years. The next foreigner to sign for them was Marshall Gaillon, a Frenchman, in 1992. It's, of course, become a much more international team since those days. But Lotto has been pretty much ever-present, except for the 1986 and 1987 Tours de France, when they were sponsored. The name of the team was Joker, which was a sub-brand of the Belgian lottery. I believe it was a sort of scratch card or some kind of sub-lottery game run by the same organisation, of course. So it's a real landmark, a real achievement, really, for an organisation to manage to keep the same sponsor for four decades. I don't know whether we're going to run through a few of the highs.
Well, I was going to ask you, Lotto, the team Lotto, the name Lotto, which rider immediately comes to mind when I say Lotto? For me, it's who?
Really?
For me, it's Schmil without any doubt whatsoever.
Yeah.
André Schmil.
Yeah, I was going to say André Schmil, I must admit, because, I mean, he was in the the greatest Lotto jersey, which was black and red halves, which looks a bit like a Blackburn away shirt from the mid-90s, doesn't it, Rob? Yeah. I thought you'd appreciate that.
Yeah, Lionel, I must say, I think that was the first ever cycling jersey that I bought, but I bought it sort of involuntarily in the sense that when I was about 15 or 16, I can't remember what the jersey I wanted was, but I was trying to order a jersey from Prenda Ciclismo, our friends, long-standing and beloved mail order company, and it might have been a Saeco jersey or something. And I remember getting a phone call back. I think it was from Mick, who the long-time owner of that company, called me back and he said, "We haven't got that one, but we've got the Lotto jersey instead." And the Lotto jersey at the time, that was sort of the least glamorous and least attractive jersey there was. And I sort of reluctantly said, "Okay, I'll have it." It was the Isoglass, the subsponsor. It was similar to the one you mentioned. It was an evolved version of the one you're talking about, Lionel, with sort of green flecks on it as well. But yeah, so the first ever cycling jersey that I bought, I think. But also when I think of Lotto, in terms of emblematic figures, I sort of told this story on the podcast a couple of years ago. I think of Jeff Brackavell, who was the long-time Direct Sportive, died a couple of years ago. This huge figure who, I don't want to be sort of derogatory here, but he sort of reminded me of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man in Ghostbusters. A very sort of a hulking figure, shall we say, with his enormous hands that, you know, were unusually sort of soft when he would kind of reach out his hand to shake your hand, and it was kind of like squeezing an enormous marshmallow. Anyway, of course, I told the story a couple of years ago on the Cycling Podcast that Hugo Corvitz, we're going to take our weekly detour to Hugo, to Corvitz Corner in a few minutes. He, and I learned this when Hugo picked me up once to take me to a race, he called Jeff Brackover every single day at bedtime, at sort of 9 o'clock in the evening. And I quizzed Hugo about this ritual, and Hugo would explain, or he explained that Jeff would be in bed next to his wife, in his, I imagine Jeff Brackover, this enormous figure, in his nightgown, and taking the phone call from Hugo and just sort of exchanging kind of gossip tidbits about what was going on in the world of Belgian cycling every single night, I think up until when Jeff Brackavell died a couple of years ago.
One of the other figures that's synonymous with the team, I think, is Mark Sargent, who won Lotto's first ever Tour de France stage in 1987 in Strasbourg with a 60-kilometre break, and then rode for them for many years, and then became sports director, general manager, one of the real gentlemen of the team bus paddock, Daniel. A few years ago, I went to Calpe in Spain. I think it was Calpe. No, it was Mallorca. They were having a pre-Christmas training camp. And I spoke to Mark Sargent at length about his career and the Lotto team. That episode is actually on our Friends of the Podcast feed if you want to go and listen to it. But just that, you know, the significance of the Lotto team, I was struck in Mallorca earlier this year, Rob, slightly diminished, you know, compared to the team that it was. It always had this huge rivalry with Quickstep, Patrick Lefebvre. I mean, ironically, Patrick Lefebvre was involved with the Lotto team in the very early years briefly. And there was this big Belgian battle, one against the other, for many, many years. They even swapped sponsors over, really, didn't they? Because for that period, from 2005 to 2011, Omega Pharma was the main sponsor of this team. I'm going to give you a little quiz here. Divitamon, Predictor and Silence were the three title sponsors. So Divitamon Lotto, Predictor Lotto, Silence Lotto. A point for each one. Can you tell me what products they made?
Pharmaceuticals.
Davitamon was vitamins.
Correct.
Silence was an anti-snoring medication of some... And Predictor was Predictor Pregnancy.
It was, yeah. Pregnancy tests and anti-snoring spray. There we go. And then they were Omega Pharma Lotto. And then, of course, became Lotto again. You ask about the riders who were synonymous with the team. André Schmiel, of course, won their first monument in 1994. Muddy Paris-Roubaix. You probably didn't like that one, Daniel, did you? But that was a real...
It was a classic, wasn't it?
Edition. It was an absolute classic. That was their first monument. But he also added Milan-San Remo in 1999 with a late attack. And he won the Tour of Flanders in 2000. between him and Peter Van Petegem and Philippe Gilbert, they won all of the monuments in cycling. They had Cadel Evans for a number of years as well, didn't they? He won the world title for them in Mendrisio in 2009, but left a few weeks later to join BMC. So he only had a handful of appearances in the rainbow jersey for the, I think by that point, they were Silence Lotto. He also had some very good performances in the Tour de France. Peter Van Petegem won the Flanders-Roubaix double in 2003, and that was the first time that had been done since Roger de Vlaeminck in 1977. They also...
And they haven't won any race since either, Lionel. Any of those two races, they haven't won
right,
since.
That's right, yeah. But they also had Johan Museo, not at the very beginning of his career, but he was a kind of stepping stone from ADR to Lotto and then on to Mapei, and he won a couple of iconic tour stages in 1990 at Mont-Saint-Michel and the Champs-Élysées in Paris. And I suppose the thing that really sort of signifies this big rivalry between these big two classic super teams was that they had Frank Vandenbroucke as a stagiaire in 1993, and he stayed for a year. He was the big Belgian prodigy of the time. And then he had the controversial transfer, early season transfers around this time of year, wasn't it, Daniel? Joined Mapei. It was a real kind of tug of war for Vandenbroucke, and they kind of wriggled him out of his contract and he joined Mapei. And the reason we're kind of talking about all of this, 40 years of the Lotto sponsorship, it's because on Sunday, to mark this anniversary, they wore a sort of mashup jersey, which I thought was really nice looking. It was lots of segments from all of the different Lotto jerseys over the years.
It was a bit of a rip-off of the EF Education jersey that they wore in the Giro d'Italia a couple of years ago. Very, very similar.
Should also mention, because we've focused there on the classics, Daniel, you mentioned Mario Aerts winning Flèche Wallonne. That was their second win in that race in a row, because the previous year, 2001, Rick Verbrugge won it. And they had two sort of generational talents in the sprinting as well, didn't they? Robbie McEwen signed for them in 2002 and won a whole bunch of Tour and Giro stages for them, won the green jersey, wore the yellow jersey, won some sort of pretty decent one-day races for them as well. Paris-Brussels, I remember. And André Greipel as well. Had a very
and
successful
Caleb Ewan.
With them.
And Caleb Ewan.
And Caleb Ewan, of course.
Resurgent Caleb Ewan, who won his second race for Ineos Grenadiers in Tour of the Basque Country before leaving after, was it 2 or 3 days?
Yes, he won the stage, the second stage, and then declared, I think. That was his week done. But this is, you know, this is a real kind of the most Belgian of Belgian teams, really, isn't it? Even more Belgian than Patrick Lefebvre's Soudal Quick-Step team in some ways, I think, because it has that kind of much more sort of domestic feel to it. And over the years, so many talented Belgian riders have come through the ranks. They had Thijs Benoot started his career with them, Tim Wellens, Thomas de Gendt rode for them for many years. They've had Victor Campenaerts. And of course, at the for a long time, they rode on Eddy Merckx bikes. Mm. You can't get much more Belgian than that.
Earthy, unglamorous and proud, I would say. Chaps, talking Belgian institutions, it's that time of the week, that now beloved, already beloved time of the week, when we take a detour to Corvett's Corner. Hugo, take it away.
Pay attention, freebie. What did I say last week? Question mark. Don't write about Van Aardhoff for the Ronde van Vlaanderen. I think a lot of people thought I was crazy after the Idrie Saxo Classic. But I also think that a number of people have changed their minds in the meantime. Van Aert has been attacked hard by the Flemish media in recent weeks. Among other things, because he didn't ride Milano Sanremo, the only monument he has won so far. Even before the Idrie Saxo Classic had Nieuwsblad headlined, Fela is no longer allowed. After Dwars door Vlaanderen, the same newspaper talked about the blunder of Waregem after he lost the sprint to Paulus. Van Aert received really a lot of criticism. And he's not immune to that. 2 years ago, after his second victory in Aarlebeke, he shouted right after the finish, "I just don't have to do anything." It all came out when he won. It's also different from Mark Cavendish, who constantly made the media his imaginary enemy to get positive vibes from it. If Cavendish had been Flemish, he would have been at odds with the media every race. Because cycling is so big in Flanders that one day you're suddenly the national hero and the next day you're being cut down by the same media. Van Aert is the crowd favorite of the Belgians and also has the profile of the ideal son-in-law. House, garden, wife, children. But because he's the crowd favorite, he also become a click machine for the digital media. And they live by big titles. Either it's super good or super bad. And then after Sunday in Oudenaarde, you get titles like "How Van Aert got even better during the Ronde van Vlaanderen." As if you feel better after 250 kilometers than after 0 kilometers. Make me laugh. The reality is that Paris-Roubaix has always been the monument that best fits Wout van Aert's profile. I remember that moment 7 years ago when he first did the reckon of the Hell of the North. He rode down Le Secteur Pavé de Moulin de Vartin. His back was so horizontally flat while cycling that you could put a plate of full glasses of beer on it. I got goosebumps during the passage of Wout van Aert. I came home and told my wife that I had seen the new Roger de Vlaeminck, the new Monsieur Paris-Roubaix. I thought he was capable of winning Roubaix 4 times too. His counter is still at zero. But I won't be surprised if Wout van Aert rides from hell to paradise on Sunday at the Velodrome André Pitrieu. Even though everyone is talking about the big three after the Ronde van Vlaanderen with Mats Pedersen, Mathieu van der Poel, and last but not least, Tadej Pogačar. As mentally tough as the setback in Waregem was, the Ronde van Vlaanderen was just as promising. In French they say, "La roue de la fortune tourne plus vite que celle du moulin." The wheel of fortune turns faster than the mill. And that's certainly the case in cycling. I am not going to contradict the quote from the Spanish writer Cervantes.
Well, any listeners who would like more Kurovitz Corner, and I'm sure that's everybody, can listen to the latest episode for Friends of the Cycling Podcast subscribers. On Monday, the morning after the Tour of Flanders, I headed to Roeselare to meet Hugo, who is enjoying, and I put that in inverted commas, retirement.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Really missing the races, isn't he, Daniel? I think that's stretching it. Well, you're here at the start.
You would never know. You would never know. He's at the roadside every single day. Whether he's watching the recon,
enjoying it in a different way.
He is.
He went to the Paris-Roubaix recon a few days ago. His daughter Gretel is part of the media team at SD Works, so he's having a day out with them on the cobblestones. I met up with Hugo. We were going to have a sort of coffee or lunch, but he suggested, why don't we meet at the Course Museum van der Wielersport in Roeselare. Now, when I was there with Simon Gill for the Lionel of Flanders series in 2017, the museum was closed for refurbishment, renovation, so I'd not been before. It was a fantastic, I mean, I barely scratched the surface of what's on display there, but I recorded chats with Hugo as we toured around the museum. We were given a guided tour by Dries Mombert, who is the curator of a lot of the exhibits there. It's an absolute Aladdin's cave of cycling memorabilia. Funnily enough, they had a whole exhibition dedicated to the 40 years of the Lotto team, really worth having a look at. There's an exhibition of Ashley and Gerard Gruber's photography on display at the moment. And of course, prominent is Jean-Pierre Montserrat, the 1970 world champion, who was from Roeselare and who was killed whilst racing in the rainbow jersey in March 1971, and I knew the headlines of that story, but to actually go and see the section of the museum that is dedicated to him really kind of increased my awareness of just the significance of Montserrat as kind of the next Eddie Merckx. They really thought he was going to be that good. That episode is available for all Friends of the Podcast subscribers to listen to. If you're a subscriber, it will have dropped into your feed by now. If you want to sign up as a friend of the podcast and support us in the process, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. The 1101 Cappuccino this week will be hitting inboxes in, well, probably later today or tomorrow. It features a piece I wrote many years ago about the 1990 Paris-Roubaix, the closest edition ever, with an asterisk, because, well, you'll read why it's got an asterisk. But that was the race between Eddie Plancarte and Steve Bauer that finished in almost a dead heat on the velodrome. And you'll also see details in there how to purchase one of Stacey Snyder's cobbled-themed cups, which are going on sale on Saturday, 10 a.m. Eastern time in the US. You'll have to work out what that is in your particular time zone. I'll put the exact on sale times for other regions in the 1101 Cappuccino, and you can sign up for that at thecyclingpodcast.com as well.
Chaps, very cryptic ending to Corbett's Corner this week with a Don Quixote reference. That's this famous story of young noble who loses his sanity and ends up fighting against windmills, which he mistakes for giant monsters. Clear links with Paris-Roubaix there. But of course, Hugo was talking about Wout Van Aert. A lot of talk in last week's podcast about him. A lot of talk after the Tour of Flanders at the weekend. Resurgent Wout Van Aert. A lot of people, Hugo said, thought I was crazy when Hugo told us not to write Wout Van Aert off. Hugo was right to a certain extent. What a vivid image that was. What a vivid picture Hugo painted there of him again, standing at the roadside, watching a recon. And in this case, Wout Van Aert's first recon many, many years ago. Hugo having goosebumps, coming back and telling his wife, I've seen the next Roger de Vlaeminck. Well, Wout Van Aert is only four cobblestones short of Roger de Vlaeminck at this stage. Of course, there's going to be a lot of talk about Van Aert at the weekend. A lot of people feeling that he is coming to form at the right time. Van der Poel, of course, defending champion. He is back at Paris-Roubaix. But I suppose the main story, as far as a lot of people are concerned, is Tadej Pogacar. Can he win Tour de France? Do what no rider has done since Lionel. No Tour de France, reigning Tour de France champion has done since.
Ridden?
No, it's one.
One?
Since... Oof.
Oh my
Eddie
goodness.
Merckx in 1970. Not that many reigning Tour de France champions, or indeed past Tour de France champions, have ridden Paris-Roubaix with any kind of distinction. There was a piece in L'Equipe, I think, today, or on L'Equipe's website, sort of running down those who had tried. Jan Janssen, Tour de France winner in 1968. 1970, went to Paris-Roubaix and finished seventh. Merckx, as we said, he was the reigning Tour champion in 1969. He won Paris-Roubaix the next year. Bernard Hinault was the reigning Tour de France champion in Tour de France, when did Hinault win his first Tour de France? 78.
78 and 79, and he won Paris-Roubaix in 81.
Yes, and in 1979, so when he was Tour de France champion, he just won his first Tour de France, he was 11th in Paris-Roubaix following year, giving lie to the myth that he only rode Paris-Roubaix once, because he did come back and win Paris-Roubaix in 1981. Greg LeMond was reigning Tour champion in 1991, Paris-Roubaix, and he finished 55th. And Bradley Wiggins in 2014, so a couple of years after he'd won the Tour de France, finished 14th in Paris-Roubaix. Tadej Pogacar is trying to go where no man except Eddie Merckx has been before. Chaps, how do we feel about this, and what's going to happen?
Excited, I would say. I mean, you're not how can you not be excited by the fact that he's at least trying? It's a massive headline for all of us. It's something that we're going to be looking forward to watching, I'm sure. Can he, can't he? We had the will he, won't he for a long, long time, for a couple of years. Now it's the can he, can't he. I mean, from a from a completely objective point of view, it's a much more difficult proposition than the Tour of Flanders, isn't it? There's less climbing. It would be a lie to say there's no climbing, but there are no real specific climbs, if you like. You know, there aren't the focal points where you say, okay, this time up he's going to do this, he's going to do that, and he's going to try and break the engine like he sort of did at the weekend with those continuous attacks. What we have to say is also that any race that Tadej Pogacar starts, he's a candidate for victory, isn't he? I would say he is a favourite, but certainly not the favourite here, because in a race like Roubaix, you bring in, you mentioned already Van Aert there, coming into form at just the right time. Van der Poel, who's the expert. There's Jasper Philipsen, who's been second in the last 2 years. There's a whole host of different riders. Ganna, Pedersen, they're in fantastic form. This is a much more open race than the one we saw last Sunday. So I'd say if you're talking probabilities and odds, they're much longer, but you can never, ever rule out Pogacar, I think, with the way that he races.
I think it's going to be difficult though, isn't it? And if the weather forecast, I mean, what are we, 3 days away? The forecast currently is for sort of some rain in the morning, quite cool temperatures. The rain, it depends how long it falls for, depends what sort of state the cobbles are in when they get to them. But that's the biggest factor in Paris-Roubaix is the weather, whether the cobblestones are wet and the wind direction. And so it's going to be, that's the kind of the deciding factor, I think, rather than, you know, whether Tadej Pogacar has a tactical plan or whether he has the strength. You know, a wet Paris-Roubaix is a real lottery, more so than any other edition, I would say. And he's up against, you know, physically bigger riders. He'll be outnumbered by physically bigger riders. Matthew van der Poel, of course. You know, Jasper Philipsen, you mentioned second the last 2 years. I mean, they've done the 1-2 Alpecin de Koenig for the last 2 years. Jasper Philipsen's in pretty good form. I mean, he was second in Skelderprijs yesterday behind Tim Melier. Mads Pedersen, you know, a big, strong, powerful rider. Filippo Ganna, I think, is an excellent shout. You know, who will be he rode really well at the Tour of Flanders, I thought, and probably a little bit too big for the hills of Flanders as they, you know, count down to the finish. But he'll be in his element, I think, at Paris-Roubaix. And it's about how worried they are about Pogacar and whether they decide to put him on the back foot early. And the big question is, what will Pogacar do on those cobbled sections? You know, the conventional wisdom is that as the sections get, you get deeper into the sections and the race gets harder, the big riders put even more power and effort into those key, tough five-star sections. Pogacar, first of all, he's got to get to the cobbles without incident. That's not a given either. It's sketchy, as you say, Rob. It's up and down, lumpy on the smooth roads before they even get to the cobblestones, and then it's a real battle to get into that first section, always is. And I suppose his strategy will be just to tick off those obstacles, get through the first section, get through Arenberg, get through the next bit, and then see where he is. It's going to be absolutely fascinating because we just don't know. And I know, you know, just saying that is a bit of a cop-out, but that's one of the beauties of this whole thing. You know, so often we watch Pogacar and we sort of know what he's going to try to do. You know, Daniel, you pretty much called it that, certainly on race day, I think you tweeted that, you know, everything was lining up for a Pogacar attack last time on the Alpe de Quarnamont. That's exactly what he did. He's kind of done that before as well when he won the previous time. Whereas this time there's no blueprint. We don't really know anything about how he'll get on. So it's going to be absolutely phenomenal to watch. And we don't get too many of these occasions where we'll sit and watch the race without any real evidence to go on. We'll just see it unfold and we'll see whether he can cling on to the coattails of the bigger riders, because they're not going to lie down and let him into the race, are they? They're going to want to put him out of contention one way or the other, get him chasing, get him in the second group or the third group, and then see what he can do.
We don't know anything. Never has a truer word been spoken on the cycling podcast. Lionel, another thing you mentioned there was the size of the riders in Paris-Roubaix. Now, this is something that I alluded to at the weekend in Ayurveda. We've talked about it in the past. Can a rider who weighs under 70 kilos win Paris-Roubaix? Well, it hasn't happened very often. There are various studies people have carried out, going off figures that sometimes are a little bit unreliable of heights and weights of riders of yore, shall we say. One I found, I was rummaging around the other day, suggests that about, I think, four riders since about 1960 have weighed under 70 kilos and won Paris-Roubaix. Emil Dams in 1963 weighed about 63 kilos, people think. Ino himself, I've seen his weight quoted as 62 kilos in 1981. I think that's wrong. I don't think he would have been that light. I think it would have been more like 65 kilos. Very similar to build to Pogacar, I would suggest, you know. Henny Kuiper in 1983 weighed around about 69 kilos. And Philippe Gilbert in 2019 was around about the 69 kilo, 70 kilo mark. I've also seen Marc Madiot being listed as weighing under 70 kilos. I'm pretty dubious about that. I would say he would have been more like 70. But the average weight of Paris-Roubaix winners is around 73 kilos, 73, 74 since sort of Second World War. So Pogacar would break the mould, shall we say. Chaps, I was looking around for other omens, maybe, comparisons with that Bernard Hinault victory in 1981. That was on the 12th of April, the day when Tom Watson won the US Masters. This is US Masters week this week. I couldn't find any sort of point of any sort of parallel there. I don't know if Bubba Watson wins the Masters. Does that mean Tadej Pogacar is going to win Paris-Roubaix? I don't even think Bubba Watson is in the Masters this year. Joe Louis died that day when Bernard Hinault won in 1981. And NASA launched their space shuttle Columbia from Kennedy Space Center. Now, this is the one thing I found. What was the first Twitter account that Tadej Pogacar followed when he joined Twitter? NASA.
Oh my goodness. There you go. What a connection.
It's a done deal, Tadej.
You've not had a busy week then, have you?
It's a done deal, old son. But incidentally, chaps, my tip for victory in Paris-Roubaix at the weekend is King Kung, Stefan Kung. Riding very, very well. He's a rider who, when he's hot, he's very hot. As we saw at the Vuelta a España last year, he didn't win a stage, but for about a week in the middle of last year's Vuelta last year, he was sizzling. And he's also someone who I think has sort of figured out Paris-Roubaix. First six times he rode it, he was never in the top 10, and he had three DNFs. And the last three times he's ridden Paris-Roubaix, he's finished third, fifth, and fifth. So I think he's got a good chance.
And he rode really well in Flanders, didn't he? I mean, there were some quotes where he was sort of saying he didn't follow the team plan. But, you know, these races, Flanders and Roubaix, the plan goes out of the window, really, doesn't it? It's about riding on you know, feel, instinct, just sensing danger, sensing opportunity. He'll be up there, won't he, when it gets hard. And I think that's the thing. Pogacar's got a lot of wheels that he could follow, hasn't he? I mean, get onto the wheel of a big guy, a sort of time trialist. And let's face it, you know, he can ride extremely fast on the flat. I mean, there's no doubting his credential. I mean, look how he rode that run in last Sunday in the Tour of Flanders, into the wind, sort of time trialing on a road bike. He's a very good time trialist. If this was a 50k flattish time trial, you would expect him to be up there with the likes of Kung, Ganna, and co. So the real unknown is how he copes with the bouncing around on the cobbles. And well, what do we have to go on? We have a kind of anecdotal evidence that he's pretty quick on them in training, recon rides.
Chaps, maybe I wasn't listening attentively enough. Maybe you covered this, we covered this earlier on in the
just
episode. But bad weather, does that help or hinder him? Because we know there is a phenomenon in cycling we have referred to as a pog weather. He, particularly in the start of his career, he used to really excel when it was coldish and wet and pretty miserable. Now he excels in all conditions. If it's treacherous, obviously Van der Poel, we think, will be at an advantage because of his bike handling skills. But what about Pog?
Well, it's the first point I made, Daniel, about the weather being the decisive factor on Sunday. If it is wet and how wet it is, again, I don't want to alarm the physics experts out there, but my sense is that heavier riders stick to the cobblestones. You know, they're sort of lighter riders bounce around more on the cobbles. I mean, this is no worse than your bit about antibiotics at the start.
It's about the same level as my NASA as the space shuttle omen.
My sense is that the heavier riders, you know, the weight and the combination of power and weight is an advantage on especially the really rough sections. Lighter riders will kind of bounce around a bit more and might be harder just to kind of keep that consistent solid line over the crown of the cobbles, get bumped down into the gutters. And I think slippery cobbles makes that a little bit more likely. I mean, we're clutching at straws a bit here, aren't we? We'll have to see. You know, that's going to be the moment of the race, isn't it? When they turn onto the first section, which is still Trouville, I believe, seeing where Pogacar is and how he gets through that first section.
We will see. Can I make a very slight Aramburu-style deviation? Because we're talking about debutants, talking about riders. Obviously, there's the big headline one, isn't there? Tadej Pogacar. Just at the other end of the start list, winner of Grand Prix de Nain, 19 years of age, Matthew Brennan is going to make his Roubaix debut. And he's somebody, without wanting to put any pressure on him, because of course he's riding,
he's
you imagine, in a plan for Van Aert. I'm not going to say he's going to win at all, but I'm really intrigued to see how he gets on, how he performs, because he's taken to professional cycling fantastically well so far. Yes, he won Dunant, but most of his racing has actually been World Tour racing so far. Tour down under, Catalonia, where he won in a couple of days as well. And there's another debutant in that team as well, Niklas Behrens from Germany, under 23 star in the World Championships. Hasn't really started that well among the pros
yet. I thought we would have seen more of him. I thought we would have seen more of him so far this year.
But he's a bit older. He's 21 already. Like you say, yeah, I was with you, Daniel. He's got through in Oman, the UAE Tour, not finished the last couple of races. But yeah, another interesting debutant to watch, as well as Tadej Pogacar, of course.
Well, chaps, I think that just about concludes today's podcast. All that remains for us to do is to wish you an exciting, enjoyable Paris-Roubaix. We'll be watching, Lionel. You'll be there on the ground, and we will be podcasting shortly after the finish. On Sunday.
We will. And before that, of course, Rose Manley and Denny Gray will be in the Velodrome in Roubaix on Saturday to recap the women's race. Now, you could get best of both worlds, Daniel. Warm, sunny weather on Saturday and a bit wet and grotty on Sunday. We'll see the two ends of the Paris-Roubaix spectrum. But Arrivé will be back on Saturday with Rose and Denny, and then Daniel and I will return on Sunday.
Until then, thank you, chaps.
Ciao.
Thank you.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.